chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them, but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. I'm your host, Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
To the show, everyone. So we've covered thus far some pretty big budget, big studio, big name rom-coms, but of course, we shan't forget the B-movie rom-coms, the Hallmark movie rom-coms, the Hallmark movie parodies on Netflix. And so today, we are going to be discussing our first of that ilk. And there is no better person to discuss films of this ilk to the nth degree, with a great degree of skepticism and keen criticism than Kate Kearns. Welcome to the show, Kate Kearns. Tell the people about yourself.
Thank you. Well, I'm Kate Kearns. I work in marketing at a local theater for my day job, so I get to think about stories in depth in that capacity. And then when I'm done trying to sell super artsy theater stuff, I come home and I ghostwrite romance novels. So, I love romantic comedies both as just something to love and watch and appreciate and, you know, wince at. But I'm also normally watching with an eye towards, if something doesn't work, why doesn't it work? What larger problems does that create in the story? Because then, you know, once I can solve it, I can either avoid that pitfall, or if they find a way around it, you know, I can steal it.
Oh boy, and I cannot wait to hear how you apply that keen eye to this particular film, which was, just so everybody is clear, a suggestion from Kate, and I had not seen it before, so I am just thrilled to discuss this with her. The film is called In Lawfully Yours.
Yes, and I did not know it was a Christian romance when I hit play the first time. Like, the thing with watching so many B-level romantic comedies is every now and then you accidentally start watching a Christian romance. And, like, most of the time you can tell right away and go, nope, nope, out. And this time it started off and I thought it was just a romance about Christian characters, and by the time I realized, oh no, wait, we're all in, there's like inspirational Christian music, I was like, this is too far in, now I need to watch this like trash fire and see what happens next. If this is your genre, if somebody out there loves Christian romances, like, I don't want to yuck on your yum, good for you, love what you love. This, I'm just talking about why this didn't work for me and why I think it doesn't work for a lot of people with similar expectations and life experiences.
Yes, I agree. I think what we are dealing with in the film In Lawfully Yours is so much more than just part of this genre of the Christian romance. I mean, really, it offers so much to so many. It is a Christian romance. It is a big town girl, small town boy story. It is a wacky bed trick comedy, perhaps. There's so much here. There's so much to offer. So before we get too much deeper into it, let's go for a summary of this film, which I'm pulling from Amazon instead of my usual Google, because this movie is more obscure than the others, and Amazon offers the better summary. Here we go. In Lawfully Yours, made in the year of our Lord, 2016. In Lawfully Yours is a romantic comedy about Jessie, a fun-loving New York City girl who, after her husband Chaz cheats on and divorces her, still graciously helps her recently widowed mother-in-law, Naomi, pack up her home in small-town Bethel Cove. But Jessie's candid wit, eccentric questions, and big-city ways clash with the local community. When Jessie butts heads with the town pastor, Ben, who also happens to be her ex-husband's brother-in-law, the unlikely duo discover what they are both looking for, each other. But when Jessie and Ben make their relationship public, Jessie's ex-husband rallies the community against her and gets Ben fired from the church. Jessie leaves Bethel Cove to bring peace to Ben's situation and to hopefully find a place where she truly belongs, in spite of the fact that she can't stop thinking about Ben. Well, Kate, that's what Amazon says that this movie is about. But what is this movie really about when we get down to it?
I think it's a lot of different movies. I think that one of the things it's going for is that kind of chaste type romance where there's like supposed to be this like lots of good dialogue. Like, you can tell that whoever wrote this probably watched Sleepless in Seattle and like other Nora Ephron things, where it's about more of the romance about taking place within a community. and how that community works, and a little bit less about, like, you know, Sex and the City, and, you know, it's very much, like, about how these people fit in their communities and what that says about how they could fit or could not fit with each other. And then there's the other element of just, you know, outsider comes in, shakes up a community. It kind of works and kind of doesn't, because, like, they don't really come down firmly on how much the community needs to be shaken up. Because at first it's like, oh no, she doesn't seem fun-loving. Like, just as a side note, she seems normal. She doesn't seem, like, fun-loving.
Yeah, I think actually we should get into that.
Like, her intro is her walking in on her ex-husband cheating on her. Which, like, the intern moment is great, by the way. I do love the part where the intern, like, upon finding out that his dad is in the hospital, like, the intern goes to, like, give the husband a hug while he's naked in front of his wife, like, to comfort him. It's just, like, that's the thing that is weird about this movie, is there are moments where, like, it's never gonna be, like, critically acclaimed, but there are moments of, like, oh, okay, you get the genre, you know what this is supposed to do. And then it goes back to being flat and bland. There is also the grief story. Like, the mom, the woman who plays the mother-in-law, that they both call mom, which, like, does not help the incest joke factor. Both of Jesse's mother-in-law and the pastor's mother-in-law. Like, that actress, the way she plays her grief over losing her husband is so genuine compared to everything else that is going on in the movie.
Yeah, there's a scene where she's walking down a hallway and she's just dragging her fingertips across the wall, and I thought, God, this is profound. This does not belong in this movie. It's actually quite moving. That scene where she kind of busts into the hotel room and finds her husband sleeping with his intern, it does sort of set you up well for a certain kind of romantic comedy and a certain kind of character. At first I thought, mm-hmm. This is the plucky girl who's been, like, screwed around by men, and she's gonna say, like, no more to men, like, I don't believe in romance anymore, and I thought that that was the movie we were getting set up for. And then suddenly we have this grief storyline, as you say, and our meet cute, notably, happens at a funeral. And I have to say that I wrote in my notes, wow, the meet cute is her kicking a guy into a grave, hashtag goals, which I stand by.
Excellent, yes, I fully support that. I like that his introduction is him brushing the dirt off of his shoulders, like, right before he launches into the funeral for their mutual father-in-law. like, there are just, like, there are elements of that where, like, that would fit so perfectly in, like, a dark indie comedy romance kind of thing. Like, there are just elements mm-hmm. of this that feel like a different soundtrack. They could be in an entirely different movie. And I feel like that makes it hard for me to draw cohesive lessons from this movie, because it does feel like it's going in lots of different places.
Right, as I said at the top, there are so many different sort of rom-com tropes going on here that it almost feels like a smorgasbord, right? Like you said, you have the cheating husband, you have the woman who's been scored, you have hot pastor, you have big city girl in a small town.
Is he hot?
You know, let's talk about it. Is Ben the pastor hot? Kate, what is your assessment?
I go as far as cute. I think they may, like, he was solid B-movie attractive. I don't think we can go as far as hot. I don't think he ever does anything that you're like, oh god, yes, lusty, I would fuck him. That said, I do 100% stand by their characterization of him as having horrible dad jokes. That is true of, like, not every pastor person I know, but, like, a high number of religious people, like, who are super involved in church life, because, like, those are the only ones they can make to everybody, so they get really invested. I do like that characterization.
Yeah, he struck me as actually, well, maybe not, as we've discussed, a hot pastor. He struck me as a believable character, and I was totally down for it, whereas Jesse as a character, so strange. So she's supposedly this big city New York girl who's too big for her britches, I guess, and is, like, too feisty and asks too many questions. And,
which they never answer. Sorry.
Right.
Continue.
They don't. They never answer her questions.
The, like, scene where she stands up during the homily and starts being like, okay, yo, but question. On the one hand, cringeworthy. Like, realistically, you have to buy in that she somehow missed the part where you're not supposed to ask questions during a homily. But, like, once they're in it, I feel like the good version of this scene would have been, like, you know, in Little Women that just came out, where Professor Bear is, like, correcting Joe's writing, and he's the first person who's cared enough to correct it. Like, the good version of this scene is she's the first person who's cared enough in a long time to, like, call him on the part where he drops a note card and makes no sense in his sermon. You know, like, so there were elements of that there, but then, but you have to buy into the fact that she is so oblivious in order to get that moment.
Right, so how can she simultaneously be this, like, oblivious naivete character, but we're also supposed to believe that she's such a big city slicker, like, big personality girl that everybody in the town believes that she is a harlot, more or less, who cheated on her husband, and also that even though she doesn't seem to have a job and that her profession seems to be taking care of her mother-in-law, that she's somehow, like, not a suitable character in this small town in Virginia, which actually seems like quite a thing that people would expect her to do.
And they kind of, they do have that nod to it of, like, oh, she dropped, she was in early education in college, she dropped out to support horrible ex's career. Like, there are, and then there's the opportunity where she has to interact with kids during the course of the story, and you kind of see that, but then they don't use that as, one of the things that I love about rom-coms is when they let characters come in, not to just themselves as a couple, but themselves as individuals, and show them moving on and, you know, taking up whatever their career is, and even if that is ridiculous, or if it's shedding what their career is. And this story kind of nodded to that, in that it's like, oh, she has a job working with kids, but she has a job that she gets without any further licensing requirements at a pastor because, or at a church because her boyfriend is the pastor. Like, ugh.
Yeah, and there's such a cringeworthy scene where that happens too, where they're at a diner and she basically says, oh no, I've run out of money. They won't accept my credit cards anymore. Whatever will I do? And he says, well, you could work for the local pastor. And she says, oh, well, I have to interview for it. And he says, no, it's all good. Which is,
no, oh God, so horrible, so horrible, so horrible. It's not good, Janelle.
It is, Kate. I think, though, maybe the part about this that I find the most cringeworthy, which I cannot believe we have yet to discuss, is that the conceit of this film is essentially a Renaissance incest plot where you have siblings-in-law who are being sort of set up by their former mother-in-law. So I just kept thinking of Hamlet running around talking about, like, a most unnatural bedding. Like, there's something about it that is just borderline creepy. I don't know. What are your thoughts about this?
I think that the plot is not inherently borderline creepy. I think they could have solved it relatively simply by just not having them call their mother-in-law mom, you know? Or, like, have one of them be more distant from the mom than the other. Like, you know, Clueless manages to have her go for her stepbrother, which is, like, way closer.
And so, somehow that works!
Yes! So I don't feel like it's inherently broken. I feel like it's that, okay, so when I'm ghostwriting, I'll often get tropes that I'm like, ooh, I do not like that trope. I find it very problematic. So that, like, sometimes it's like, oh, dating her boss or whatever. Then I have to figure out, okay, what do I do? How do I set up this story so that that element of it is not, you know, best boring and at worst morally objectionable. And it feels like in several places here, they, which is interesting for a movie about a religious community, which theoretically cares about morals, like, they didn't really think through the moral implications of several points of the story, which to me gets in the way of it having a feel good. Like, I don't need you to be a, quote, good person to be the hero or heroine of a romantic comedy, but I need there to be an element of emotional justice in the world that has been created. And I don't think this movie had it.
Yeah, because even, because Jessie's journey in this case as our lady protagonist, I mean, she's getting over her horrible husband who cheats on her all of the time and then has the gall to say that he's morally superior to her in some way because he's not pursuing the widower of his sister, which feels so frustrating in so many ways. And then his mother backs him up about it at one point, which is just horrifying. Jesse's journey kind of going from the scorned wife of a rampant cheater to the, you know, loving wife of local pastor is, it is a journey, but I think you're right. There is not a lot of emotional justice in it unless you believe in the sort of conversion story at the heart of
yeah.
this.
Yeah. Like, she doesn't grow as a person. She just swaps out a douchey man for a good man. Which, realistically, like, that's kind of how a lot of relationships, like, growth happens. Sometimes there actually isn't anything wrong with you or nothing that bad wrong with you. It is actually the person you're with, and when you're with a better person, like, it does not magically make your life perfect, but, like, not dating someone who's cheating on you magically solves a lot of problems. So, like, there's an element of realism-ish, but, like, that's not what we go to stories for. We go to it for that character arc, and the only arc that she does is arcing into belonging in this community, and the part where it starts, the story starts faltering for me is actually once she, like, she and Ben are dating, and she has the job at the church, and she's magically dispensing wonderful advice to this girl about, in my notes I had pearl metaphor, so cringy, and then underlined seven times. Like, you know, she's, like, citing these stories that she didn't, had no idea even existed a second ago, and doing it casually and awesomely, but, like, in that horrible youth pastor voice. The thing with an outsider plot of, oh, this person is coming into this community that needs to be shaken up and causing trouble by shaking up this community. There needs to be a little bit more, I don't know, of a ruckus, more complications, more something, because it just feels like she has seen the light and now she is a different person. But she isn't actually a different person. She just knows Bible verses now.
Yes, as a non-believing city girl myself, I did find it very difficult to connect with Jesse. And it made me think a lot about how, as a person who did not grow up in faith, who didn't grow up going to church, that these Christian romances are difficult for me to sort of understand. But I think it's worth talking about why they're so popular and what they give to people as a kind of form for the rom-com. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
So I was thinking about that in relation to C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia. The idea that, like, obviously there are parts of those that have aged horribly. They honestly read much better when you're a kid and don't realize all the, you know, colonialism you're also absorbing. But, like, there is this idea of it works entirely in and of itself as a solid fantasy story. But then, also, if Christianity is meaningful for you, and if you're versed in its, you know, tropes and stories and metaphors, then you have this stacking of layers where you're also getting this other richness on top that the story doesn't need and still functions without, but it's there if you are part of that community. And I think in my ideal world, that's what a Christian romance would be. It would be a romance that functions in and of itself as a romance. But then also, if you're part of this community, it's written in a way where you get to see yourself reflected and you get nuance that maybe you wouldn't get otherwise. The ones that I have seen so far, which I haven't seen many of them, but there isn't as much of that. It should function in and of itself, whether or not you believe. Religious community is, like, when they work well, one of the things that they do very well is offering people a sense of community and unconditional support. And I think romantic comedies, when they work well, often do a good job of portraying community and unconditional support. So it seems like the two things should go in hand a lot better than I have yet to see them go hand in hand. And I'm not really willing to watch enough to, like, find out if it's just because I'm not watching enough.
That makes me think, too, that this movie, I mean, it gets a degree towards this idea of finding community and finding a place where you belong and unconditional support. So I see that in this movie, or at least it's trying to do that, but I think mm-hmm. you're right. It doesn't really function, though, in that same way without believing really strongly in Jesse's sort of sudden conversion to good personhood through religious conversion. And I think that that's even more undercut in the film by how the town essentially slut shames her and has fairly openly misogynistic attitude towards her up until the very end when they say, Oh, what? You mean her ex-husband was lying about her? Shocker. I never.
Like, normally when you talk about trying to bring, like, representation of different groups into a story, if you are going to only have one member of a given group in the story, that puts so much more burden on trying to have that person represent everything that the community that they are a part of is. And as the story stands, there are a lot of people who are theoretically practicing Christians in this movie. And so that part, like, it's kind of ish worked for me. Like, there's like, oh, there's the people who think it's this, and there's the people who think it's this, and there's the people who, like, only come if they're anticipating drama and someone's going to shame their enemy at church, then they'll go. But otherwise, they're going to stay at work at their diner. Like, you know. But for Jessie, she's the only person in the entire movie who is not religious and also not the villain of the movie. I feel like in not letting there be any good people in the movie who are not religious and stay not religious the whole time, it, like, puts a lot more pressure on Jesse's conversion story of, like, how are you going to make this genuine? How are you going to make this feel not like propaganda? And it didn't live up to that.
Yeah, especially because the film really makes a solid point at various different angles that Jessie had bad parents, she had an absent father, she had a mother who didn't know how to raise her. And so there's almost this subtext that Jessie was this lost sheep. There's even a speech to this. I shouldn't even say it's subtext. It's literally text, right? So she was a lost sheep who was adopted by a good Christian family, a la her husband's mother and father. And this is her real family. And this church is her real home. And this community is her real community. And we just need to show her that. And there is a world, as you say, where that could have worked if they were a little bit more generous to Jessie's origins, instead of sort of saying that, oh, well, she was lost from the flock, not because, you know, she maybe was not aware of Christian doctrine, or maybe it was just not something she had come around to yet. But it's like, well, as we know, she was bad. She was a bad seed, but we're converting her, and so now everything's going to be fine.
Her speaking up and saying, okay, but actually, I have questions, works great as, like, the outsider coming in. It works great as shaking things up. It works great as showing that engagement is not necessarily obedience. There were many things I liked about it, but then they never show the answers. She literally asks, do you think all other religions are wrong? And then they cut to the next scene. Like, that would have been such an easy, soft, curveball answer to just be like, we're not, like, we value all viewers. Like, even just, if only from a commercial make your movie sell perspective, like,
geez, and, like, what a romance it would have been if we had seen the pastor answering her questions as, like, part of their romance, right? Like, yeah. That kind of theological conversation could have been part of the blossoming of their relationship. Like, whoa, that would have been dope. Why didn't mm-hmm. they do that? Because propaganda, unfortunately.
The romance is at its strongest point when the story treats Jessie as an equal and as capable. There's that bit where, because she keeps interrupting service, she basically gets banished to the children's room, like, literally infantilizing her. Then she leads the revolt and they come back out and ask questions, and now all the kids are on her side and everyone's like, okay, she's cool. And then she's okay with that. She never says, that wasn't cool that you tried to send me off into another room and hush my questions. Like, and she just is like, accepts it as, oh yeah, it's okay for me to get shut off with the children. That's fine. That's where I belong. And, like, it comes so close so many times to being about somebody wrestling with what they believe and what is expected of them, which I think could fit very well in a courtship and romance narrative of what do you actually believe should be in a relationship and what are you okay having people expect of you and what are you not okay having them expect of you.
Yeah, and on the other side of the courtship, it would have been really cool to see more of Ben, because we find out much later, almost towards the end of the film, that he'd been wearing his wedding ring the whole time as a tribute to his dead wife. Mm-hmm. And you kind of wish that at the same time, as you're saying, he could have been struggling with his own sort of fealty to his marriage and to his wife and the complexities of that when you have really strong Christian faith. Yeah, that would have been so deep. And that is the kind of entangled romance we're looking for.
Yeah. I do like, like's a strong word. I think that the element of introducing the evil church lady, like, who's on the board and, like, can fire him, like, they play it a little bit too strong and a little bit too long, but that first element where it's like, oh, this person can fire you from your job in disgrace if she does not, like, and, like, completely take away your livelihood if she does not like how you are carrying out your reputation and personal relationships within the community, to me felt almost Jane Austen-esque of like, oh, this is a community where you could kind of start doing courtship narratives of that historical narrative of when reputation mattered in a different way than it matters now. Like, I was like, oh, that could be an interesting take on it. And then they didn't really do a good enough job of explaining or convincing you why that mattered. And then also, even when they fire him, they don't really fire him. So that took away those stakes. Like, it felt like this movie had actually real things to talk about. And then they took away all the stakes by having there either be no consequences or weirdly disproportionate consequences. And then also gave it a bad soundtrack of, like, acoustic guitar music.
So, Kate, to wrap things up, what are our main takeaways from In Lawfully Yours? What can we take away from this film that gives us so much grief over what it could have been?
Okay, I think that one of the things that you have to be aware of when you're working with tropes is both what people go to the tropes for, because you don't want to disappoint them. Like, you don't want to not sell them the thing you want. Like, if Jesse and Ben had, like, had sex on the first date, like, that would have violated the whole premise of this movie and would not have worked. But I also think, like, at the same time, you have to understand, like, ways to account for the potential problems built into the tropes. And I think one of the problems of doing this type of, you know, Christian newcomer narrative, especially where the woman is the newcomer, basically undermining your heroine, like, whenever you do a plot where it's like, oh, the woman doesn't really know what she wants. Like, at one point in the story, they're arguing over what's best for the mother-in-law. Jesse says, like, we should listen to her. She says she wants to leave. We should let her leave. And he says, Ben basically doesn't think they should listen to the mother-in-law. And of course he ends up being right. Like, he was right about this. The mother-in-law didn't really want to leave. She was being pressured. But that carries into this idea of this movie doesn't listen to Jesse, really, when she asks questions, until it wants to play lip service to the idea of, oh, we like her because she raises questions, and she introduces a question series at the start of the sermon in, like, the coming, you know, epilogue of 3 years later. But even that, the first question that someone asks is, like, a joke question about the crossword. So it's like, well, really, how much change did you actually make room for her to make? Like, they aren't careful to make sure that it shows that your heroine is listened to and respected. And I think that if you are going to take a story into an arena where in many communities women aren't listened to or necessarily respected in the way that all viewers would wish they were, like, you just have to be very careful of it. And this movie isn't careful of it. They don't really listen to their heroine, and, you know, her characterization and the whole movie suffers for it.
I'm very intrigued by what you said about allowing her to ask questions and to take those questions seriously. And it makes me think that there's something here that we can take away from this film. That is that faith, like romance, is sort of this dance of persuasion. And the more you allow the persuasion to run its course, rather than to lead that horse to water, whether it wants to go or not, the better your ultimate relationship is going to be, whether that's a relationship between two people or that's a relationship between a person and their faith and their belief in something. So, hey, look at that. This movie is garbage, but we found some good stuff in it, Kate.
Woo!
On the show here, we like to offer some antidotes to these terrible movies. Sometimes terrible, sometimes profound, oftentimes both. K, Kate, what are your antidotes for In Lawfully Yours?
Okay, so it depends on what you went to this movie for. I don't have a perfect antidote that, you know, wraps up everything. I think my first recommendation is While You Were Sleeping with Sandra Bullock. It is the story of a woman who, because of rom-com shenanigans, this man ends up in a coma and everyone thinks she's engaged to him. She's not. But the family then, like, welcomes her with open arms, and then, like, she falls for his brother, and meanwhile everyone is, like, treating her like she's in this relationship with this guy, and they're, like, so excited that she's gonna join the family, and it's, like, her, like, basically falling in love with the family, and then also on the side, his brother. And there's even a church scene where they, like, argue in the pews. I think if you're going for that kind of warm family, it does have, like, people who are religious in it, although it isn't a story about religion. It's gorgeous and lovely, and I highly recommend it. And I think, okay, so there was this Amazon reviewer for In Lawfully Yours who, like, gave the movie 5 stars. They loved it. And it was because there was no nudity in it, but it was more interesting than Hallmark movies. And I thought, okay, that's fair. If you're looking for rom-coms that are more interesting than Hallmark movies, but also don't have nudity, like, you're kind of limited. So While You Are Sleeping, or While You Were Sleeping, is a rom-com with no nudity in it, and also more interesting than a Hallmark movie. Oh, if you want more of the person coming into, newcomer coming into a town and, like, shaking things up aspect of it, I would either go for the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society on Netflix. It's also an amazing book, which has a woman coming into a town and kind of asking questions and poking around and shaking everything up. And also, you know, spoilers, but leaving her flashy city boy fiancé and falling for a man who's, like, humble country boy. And then the city version of that would be The Butcher's Wife, which has, like, structural problems in the endings, but, like, is a woman who can see the future and goes up against a therapist who has science on his side, and they both try and, like, war over who gets to give advice in this small New York neighborhood.
My recommendation is a little bit off kilter, but I think it will scratch an itch for people who are looking for a story of a girl wrestling with faith, even in a subtle way, and that is Patti Smith's memoir, Just Kids, because it begins by showing you Patti Smith's early life as a teenager in a Jehovah's Witness community in Pennsylvania, and her journey sort of away from that initial faith towards a more sort of spiritual life in the big city, in New York. So she's, instead of a big city girl going to the small town, she's a small town girl going to the big city, and asking a lot of questions of the world and getting some damn answers in the form of her own art. And that is a big antidote to me for some of the bad vibes I might have gotten from this film if I didn't enjoy watching it so much for this conversation. Well, Kate, you are the real freaking deal. And thank you so much for coming on and bringing all of your expertise in the rom-com genre and the romance novel genre to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely speaking with you, as always.
And you as well, and you as well.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked this episode, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Rom-Com Killjoys. And if you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys to gain access to exclusive bonus content. Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog. And the song you're listening to now is a cover of one of my favorites, Baby Love, by Colin Langanis. Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy. Not a rom-com, not me, not anyone. See you next time.